This lovely day will lengthen into evening. We'll say goodbye to all we ever had. Alone, where we have walked together, I'll remember April and be glad. I'll be content. You love me.
Hello and welcome to episode 3.15, the April 17th, 2024 Snowmower Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Lachlan, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Well, I can't say I was completely happy with how the total solar eclipse turned out, but neither can I say I was unhappy. That shadow of totality, the sudden chill in the air, the darkening of the skies, the 360-degree sunrise-sunset phenomenon, turkey vultures flying madly around in the sky, all of that was quite exhilarating. But I must confess that not being able to see the corona effect due to the cloud cover in the area was disappointing. We caught a small sliver of the eclipse a few minutes before totality, but the sun was too obscured to see the entire effect. And of course, not 45 minutes later, the skies cleared right up, and we did manage to see the moon pulling away from the sun as the eclipse ended. Sort of a consolation prize. April weather is like that. One day you're brushing the snow off your car, the next day you need to cut the grass. Hence the portmanteau title for this edition. You might have to keep both snow blower and lawn mower at the ready for the next couple of weeks. We'll start this edition of the podcast with a look at one of Giuseppe Verdi's last operas, La Rondine, which translates to The Butterfly. It's a lighthearted piece with lots of beautiful music, and Dr. Robert Strauss joined me to discuss the upcoming production by the Metropolitan Opera's Live at the Met. One of my favorite guests is with me now. It's Dr. Robert Strauss from the voice faculty at SUNY Fredonia. He's here to talk with me about the upcoming Live at the Met production of La Rondine, which will be filmed, screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, April 20th at 1 p.m. Rob, as always, so good to have you.
You're so kind to me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you deserve it. That's why, you know. You really are one of my favorite guests. So we're going to talk about La Rondine, and actually it's a funny thing because this particular opera is one, I think it's one of Puccini's last operas, and it is one piece of fluff, I found out. I think that's probably one way to look at it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be unkind to it. It has gorgeous music, but it seems even Puccini was a little unhappy with the story part of it as he revised it several times to figure out how to make the ending work better.
I mean, you know, Puccini's music is always lovely, but yeah. This particular, there's nothing really, it's really not high operatic. I mean, nobody dies. What's going on here? There's no real major tragedies. It's really sort of like, I guess we would call it in our day, first world problems.
Well, kind of, you know, look, I want people to come to this. And I think that's part of why this exists. And Magda's aria in the first act, the Chi bel sogno, is just about the most gorgeous aria ever. But the story itself, as I, and the thing is, I've never been involved in a production. I have friends who've been in a production, so I've heard snippets and all of that. But it seems very similar to the plot of Traviata, but not really as filled out.
What I was trying to get at actually was this is going to be a good time because, operas are usually people feel that they're heavy and they're
Oh,
dramatic,
sure.
but this is light. And I think he was commissioned as an operetta to begin with. And so he kept it kind of light and airy and, no great tragedies and stuff like that. Just kind of, the people in high society cavorting about doing what high society people do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was commissioned as an operetta. It was meant to be comic. I hope that it is. I look at the story and it's a down on her luck woman. Who isn't able to marry the man that she wants to because she's not high society enough, or she's got blots on her past. And at the end, she goes back to the man who will is willing to take care of her, is willing to take her in. And so that, I guess, to me, that story doesn't seem very funny. It might have been in the time period, and so maybe that's the thing. Maybe I'm too woke.
When I look at the Met production and I sort of they've put it in I think they've set it just a little bit further ahead from where the original is that correct?
Yes.
The setting, it's an Art Deco setting. It looks like a 1920s setting. But Puccini wrote this. Actually, he wrote this and its opening was a delayed by World War I. So people are going to have a good time seeing the set. It looks gorgeous. The costumes look gorgeous.
The costumes do look gorgeous, and but I think of the flapper era costumes, and they tend to only look good on one very rare body type.
Right. That's right.
And so, as I look at these pictures, I'm like, they made it work. As far as the costumes are just gorgeous,
Yeah.
and the soprano Angel Blue, I'm so thrilled that she's having this career, because I experienced her the first time. It was probably on YouTube, dressed as a fairy princess talking to children. So she just seems like a really, really sweet, giving person. And I love it when that person is successful in this career.
Yes, and she's had quite a career. She's gone from, having looked at her biography, she's gone from, being a model. She was a model in her teenage years in LA. And she went to school for operatic singing. And now I listened to her, as a matter of fact. She just recently at the Met played Micaela in the Carmen that was out. And she was
Right.
gorgeous. She knocked out that aria in the. What is it, the third act, I think? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the one where she
Yeah, I
comes
think that's
looking
right.
for him and finds him in the camp, and
Yeah.
tries to persuade him to come home.
Your mom wants you to come home. That
That's right.
area.
Yeah. Oh my God. She really did a really very good job. And that was the first time I think I had ever heard her sing. So I think she's going to be absolutely delightful in this role. We can talk about the three. Different endings, I think. Like you said, it had multiple endings. Puccini had several different kinds of endings to it. The first one is the one we're going to see at the Met,
And
right?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Puccini wasn't really happy with the other ones he came up with either. So it was just sort of, and it was, later in his life, and maybe he also wasn't so used to comedy.
Oh, you think so?
Well, you Madame Butterfly, La Bohème, Tosca. I mean, someone's going to throw themselves off a building. Bohème has m wonderful comic moments as far as that goes. But perhaps it was just difficult with a story like this that didn't have the. Again, I want people to go. It's going to be gorgeous, and
It
you're
is
right.
going to be gorgeous, and I think people will go. But I'm always fascinated by the process and Puccini's process. I mean, he rewrote things, and my research says that in his third ending that he couldn't take it anymore, so he had Magda drown herself somehow in I don't know, a cocktail bowl or something like that. I have no idea, and I think that version has actually had two productions, but we won't see that one here. But it was like,
Yeah.
I can't take it anymore. Somebody's got to die.
Right, maybe so, but the story doesn't really warrant it. There's no hint that that would be
No,
something she
no.
would
And to
do.
a certain extent, it's like it's tragic in a sense because it's about love, lost love. You can't marry the person that you want. But at the same time, these people are so high society. I mean, people should know, the opera takes place in Paris and then it moves to the French Riviera. So we're not exactly talking about, people who don't have means. But and that's what I mean. I mean, these things, when you put them out, these kinds of operas, and it's also a short one. I think it's like only 2 hours and 47 minutes. So it's a very short opera as well. But I that's what I think. I think people will love some of the music. That you mentioned one of the arias, but are there a couple of others that are prominent?
Of course there are. I just frankly, the Qui bel sogno in the first act, just I'm so the way that you have to float those high seas, I want to be able to do that. So I listen to it over and over again, but as I listen to it, the orchestra colors are very, very rich. The exploration of chromaticism is interesting. It still absolutely sounds like Puccini. So if you love Puccini, you're going to love it. But he certainly was exploring different avenues in music and challenging himself in ways. So I think that's fascinating. And I was also thinking just now about the story. I don't know why I always think so much about the story, but I suppose if you look at it from the point of view of someone who tries to escape her life, that this romance with Ruggero is sort of a fantasy that just can't be true. Rather than maybe I'm comparing it too much to Traviata, which really is a tragedy, whereas this is just a person who has this opportunity. She knows it's not going to work out. She's encouraged to follow this path, even though everybody around her knows it won't work out. And so maybe there's not as much unhappiness going back to the life that she was leading, just knowing, well, I had this fling, I had this experience, and then I'll drown myself in a cocktail bowl.
That's it. That's it. That's really it. Some of the talent is really interesting, apart from Angel Blue, it's there's a guest conductor, Speranza Scappucci. She's going to be on the podium for this particular opera. I know that Jonathan Tettelman, I've heard him sing. He's really pretty nice as a Ruggero, the love interest for Magda. Have you heard him at all?
I've listened to clips and he sounds great. I mean, it's a Puccini tenor. It's exciting. It's virile. It's vibrant. Yeah, I love it.
I love, hey, Puccini tenor. I'll remember that next time.
Again, it's jealousy is what it is.
Behzad Davidov is also there. He's playing the poet Prunier. Emily, I can't pronounce Emily's last name because I believe it's Polish, but Bogorelka is Lisette, the maid who Prunier tries to turn her into a lady, is not successful. She comes back and says, "Can I have my job back to Magda? I'd like to be your maid again." Okay,
Yeah,
all good.
exactly. Yeah, and I love that she's a singer. I love when that happens in operas and musicals where the person and she goes off to try to be a singer and fails.
And fails, a failed singer. Yes, I know, it's great. I also know that again, trying to point out to the fact that this is going to be an entertaining opera musically, is that there are, Puccini filled this with romantic arias, light waltzes. He had the intention of making this an opera where people would have dancing routines. I think there's at least two major sections in the opera where people go off and dance, actually. So I think that should be interesting as well. Just to emphasize that, it's not heavy, it's light, it's entertaining.
Well, and it's going to be great because the Met doesn't do it badly.
No, the Met does not do it badly. The Met does hardly ever does anything badly. It's really funny when I see something like that, having directed an opera or two, it's like I would just love one chance to be able to direct like that and
invent something and say, I know this is going to cost $1 million, but can we do it? And somebody comes back to me, oh, yeah, sure, no problem, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. It is absolutely not let's put on a show in a barn.
No. So you're always good with the Met. I'm looking at another production photo right now, and it's just so gorgeous. Top hats, tuxedos, flapper dresses.
Well, that era is gorgeous. And again, they pulled it off beautifully. And as you say, the sets and the costumes and the music, it's well worth attending.
Yeah, it's well worth attending. I don't think, most everything that Puccini ever did. I know, again, this was towards the end of his life, and it was warmly received. The initial reviews were good. People enjoyed it, all of that kind of stuff. I think the war interfered with its popularity because it had to move locations. It wasn't able to open, in Austria. But since then, it's not exactly – people don't produce it all that much. But I think when they do, people are surprised and go – oh, yeah, that's really nice.
Well, maybe it's just the fact that there is Tosca and Madame Butterfly and La Boheme that exist. And so if your company's going to put on Puccini, it's like, well, why wouldn't you do those?
Yeah, right. Well, the one after La Rondine, of course, is going to be Madame Butterfly. That's coming up later in the season. So, get your ice cream now while you can. Because the heavy one's on its way. Well, Rob, thank you very much. As always, I appreciate your time. Once again, La Rondine at the 1891 Opera House, live at the Met, Saturday, April 20th, 1 p.m. Angel Joy Blue. She is worth the price of admission.
More than, yes.
More than. Okay. Thanks, Rob. We'll be talking to you again, as always. Appreciate it.
Great.
Much.
Thank you again so much.
The Live at the Met production of Giuseppe Verdi's La Rondine will be screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, April 20th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for members, and $10 for students, and can be had by calling the box office at 716-679-1891 or by going online at www.fredopera.org/tickets. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver.
How is Ruth sick?
It's weirdish, I know not. She seems to walk like a dead one since last night.
Betty, now stop this, Betty. Sit up now.
Have you tried beating her? I gave Ruth a good one, and it waked her for a minute. Here, let me have her.
No, he'll be coming up. Listen, now, if they be questioning us, tell them we danced. I told him as much already.
Hi. And what more?
He knows Tituba conjured Ruth's sisters to come out of the grave.
And what more?
He saw you naked.
Oh, Jesus. What do we do? The village is out. I just come from the farm. The whole country's talking witchcraft. They'll be calling us Witches Abbey.
They'll be calling us Witches Abbey. She means to tell. I know it.
One of the most enduring works in the American theatrical canon is Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Written in 1953, The Crucible is Miller's partially fictionalized account of the 1692 Salem witch trials, and is generally regarded as a metaphor about the McCarthy-era communist hearings. And while the Department of Theater and Dance is producing this play in the coming weeks, director Dan Lanzian has added a twist, a concurrent production of Roberto Aguirre Sarcasa's 2012 follow-up, Abigail 1702. Here's Professor Lanzian to give us the lowdown on this double feature.
It is always a delight to talk to Assistant Professor Dan Lanzian from the Department of Theater and Dance over at SUNY Fredonia. He is the director of the upcoming production. Well, he's actually got two productions. This is a two-for-one, people. You're going to enjoy this. It's a production of The Crucible, side-by-side with a production of what I have found to be an interesting script called Abigail 1702. So, Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I'd love to have you. It's kind of ironic that both of us happen to be deep into Arthur Miller at this point, isn't it?
Congratulations on the price. That's so exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Open in a couple of weeks. And, it's a good thing the listening audience can't see the bags under my eyes. But, it's all good. So, listen, I have to ask you right away, you are establishing a reputation as somebody who does offbeat, interesting, contemporary stuff at the college now. And so here you are doing one of the most recognized plays in the American canon alongside a play that sort of takes us in another direction with sort of the same story, but not quite. How did you get to do this project?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Like part of our mission as a department is to present material from the entire history of theater, right? And hopefully, according to recent conversations too, we're really expanding kind of what that means. One of the things that came up this last rotation was a modern play. And in thinking about it, I hadn't even sort of suggested The Crucible. I think someone else from the department had. And I had, you know, thought about it or thought, oh, I don't know, you know. And then what came to me or what really struck me was remembering, I teach in one of my classes a play called The Muckle Man by Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, mm-hmm. and that he wrote a play called Abigail 1702, a twice told tale about kind of Abigail. And it was on my bookshelf. I had never read it. So when The Crucible was pitched, I read it and said, hey, what if we were to do these two plays in rep? And really that's how the ball got rolling. But I think initially at first, I'm no stranger to heightened language, but The Crucible felt like this sort of giant kind of a huge play. And I thought, oh gosh, how am I going to tackle this? And one of the earliest sort of ideas that came to me about it was this idea of the woods, that this Puritan sort of society exists kind of in the wilderness. There are a bunch of houses and there's 20 miles of woods between them and everything else. And so the sort of this sort of hanging kind of woods that would sort of be lowered in and encroach on the company came to my mind really early on and sort of stayed with me. And then I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if Abigail was also sort of a part of that because of the way that it was written? And so the design kind of early inspiration also helped me kind of really tie these two plays together.
Well, let's talk a little bit just about Abigail 1702. I'm pretty sure most of the people listening are going to have some familiarity with The Crucible, but give us a plot summary so we kind of know where the parallels are in Abigail 1702.
Yeah. I mean, I really hope that people who are listening to this will consider seeing both plays because I think it's really exciting and I'm thinking of them kind of as like one mega play, although they are different and absolutely stand on their own. So if people only want to see The Crucible or only want to see Abigail, they're absolutely welcome to do that. Abigail takes place 10 years after the events of The Crucible, where we meet a person named Ruth Meadow, who is working in a pox house. A young pirate shows up on her doorstep saying that he has the pox, and she kind of takes them in and they sort of strike up, a friendship, maybe bordering on a romance, which leads to the literal devil finding Abigail and saying, you know, you signed my book all of those years ago and I need to collect on what is mine. What's sort of interesting is that in The Crucible, there is no supernatural. There's an Easter egg kind of in this version. Mm-hmm. In recent productions of The Crucible, in the Ivo Ivanova production in New York, there was like flying girls and a literal wolf on stage. And this is The Crucible as you will recognize it. There is no supernatural in it. But Abigail is decidedly supernatural because Aguirre-Sacasa was the show writer of, this was after he wrote this play, of Riverdale and the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and Glee. And so it's a much more contemporary take that does kind of deal with the supernatural. But I think for me, asks the question that I find to be so interesting, what is atonement? And can you atone? And what can be forgiven? And can, like, you know, and you know, are we ever forgiven or expunged of the stuff that we do?
And that is, you know, probably one of the most existential questions you can possibly ask, especially in the realm of theater, which is designed to ask those existential questions and,
right,
you know, put them out there for our consideration. So the connection between the two plays is really, you know, centers around the Abigail character, of course, as she comes, as we see her in The Crucible as a young girl, and then we see her 10 years later in Abigail 1702. But do you, I know this is a kind of a difficult question to ask, and maybe because I couldn't find it, so maybe I'm not smart enough to find it. But, you know, Miller wrote The Crucible as a parallel to the McCarthy era, and just about everybody knows that in terms of the way we, you know, hunt people down and accuse them of things. And we find a lot of that, you know, in my opinion anyway, today, you know, through the X-verse, I guess it's called now, and whatever. But I'm not sure I catch if there's any connection to that in terms of Abigail 1702, or if you see that maybe as something that hopefully might come about at some point in time in terms of its themes of forgiveness.
You know, I think Abigail 1702 was written around 2010, 2011, and Stokowska has a really interesting background. He went to Yale as a playwright, and he his day job as a playwright for a long time was writing comic books. And so he was writing the scripts of comic books and actually worked on the Archie comic book, which is eventually how he started writing on Riverdale. He also had this really sort of these couple of unique plays. I think one of them is called Dark Magic, which is like a book where the characters from The Tempest come out of it and like wreak havoc on New York City. So I think that he, with all of his kind of backgrounds, if we think about like the comic books and the Yale School of Drama and writing plays and all of those sorts of things, you can sort of see where the idea of kind of mashing up the character of Abigail with a contemporary play, with this devil, with this stuff could exist. I also think it's really interesting that there are aspects of the play Abigail 1702 that show up later in the chilling adventures of Sabrina. Oh. And so it's almost as if it's something that the playwright or that Sacasa himself is kind of thinking about or wrestling with. And I think perhaps Abigail, you know, I can't say, hopefully he'll write us in after listening to this and correct me, but I don't necessarily see if there was any kind of direct correlation between McCarthyism or the McCarthy hearings, but I do think that they are themes in the play that the playwright himself does come back to. And what better character to kind of think about, you know, atonement for than Abigail. Whenever I talk about this play, it's very interesting that people will always, so they have a real visceral reaction to the character of Abigail Williams. And they'll say, oh, she's horrible, or she's this, or she's that. And the given circumstances are she's a 15-year-old girl, which, you know, at the time, I guess, was a legal age of consent, but that is a very young person, you know, who had an affair with this guy who's married. There's a great line in the play that I always come back to that Elizabeth says, you know, John spoke her silent, a promise is made, a promise was made to that girl when you were with her. And I think that I'm interested to see people's reactions to the character of Abigail Williams after seeing both plays, if they have the same kind of gut reaction to her that they do after just reading The Crucible. Interestingly, too, The Crucible, there's a scene in The Crucible that is often cut that we have restored. That's Act 2, Scene 1 between Abigail and John Proctor. It does not appear, it was not on the Broadway production because apocryphally, I guess they couldn't tech it. But it is in some productions. It's not in other productions. But I have chosen to restore it to give kind of Abigail a little bit more of a story because of the other play. And so I think that that's also something that's really going to be interesting for audiences who may know the play to see this scene that is rarely performed.
Yeah. So two questions on that. Number one, in terms of casting, have you cast Abigail in both productions, or you have one Abigail in Crucible and one Abigail in Abigail 1702?
Yeah, some of the characters are distinct and some of them bleed over, but the Abigail is the same actor played by Harlequin Celajon, and I think they are amazing. And there are other characters I don't necessarily, well, I'll tell you that Elizabeth Proctor is also in both plays, and mm-hmm. Elizabeth Proctor is played by KK La Barbara. I thought initially, you know, when you're working with these things, as you know, Tom, they go through so many drafts in your head, right? I sort of say, like, when you meet a play, it's kind of like dating, where you take it out to different places and see if you like each other. and so it's like, at first I thought, oh, maybe there'll be different characters, or maybe the entire cast of The Crucible will show back up in Abigail, or, you know, vice versa. Or I had an idea of like a book that opened that was going to shine down light, and then the book was going to be in Abigail, and all of these kind of different things that you sort of cycle through or go through. And one of the earlier ideas that I had was, what if Abigail were different, or if Elizabeth were different, or something like that. And I just kind of came to the conclusion that I liked both actors tracking through both plays. And like I said, there's an Easter egg character as well, and you'll sort of see that. I thought that was really important for me, and important for audiences to stay with two actors who have seen them kind of go through what they went through in one play and then see it in the next play.
Yeah, that's almost making it very tempting to go see both plays to watch the actors actually work both plays instead of saying, well, I know The Crucible, I'll just go see Abigail 1702.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The other question I have really quickly for you is the language has to be very different from one play to the other. Miller wrote a very, very distinct kind of language for The Crucible that he tried to recreate how they would have talked in Salem and in 1692. And I don't think that Acosta actually did that in Abigail 1702, although I haven't read the script, so you'll have to tell me.
No. I mean, I would definitely say that the script is still, Sacasa is still playing with a poetry and poetical form, but it is not the language of The Crucible. But I think it's 10 years later, I think it's doing something different. So again, I think it's very poetic language, but it is not the same. The cast and company of The Crucible has really met the language of the play in an incredible way. And they are making it make sense. I often say to them, I think the work you're doing is so great. I don't know how high schools do this play. And if you've seen, you know, in all respect to the high schools, if you've seen The Crucible at a high school, I'm going to argue that you've probably not seen it. Letters can be addressed to Tom Laughlin at ilc.com.
Well, you know, I'll take the letters because I agree with you. I mean,
very hard.
Very hard. The language is so dense and it's so thick and it's so, you know, we're finding that actually in Buffalo doing The Price because it's Miller, you know, 18 years later and it's still the same Miller. I mean, it's wordy, it's dense, it's got all kinds of attachments to it that you really don't see that work underneath. And The Crucible is like got a ton of that stuff. So it's hard for student actors, high school actors, I can't even imagine. But even for, you know, college level BFA actors, still a challenge.
But they are really rising to the challenge in a way that I just think is so admirable and so incredible. And they're making connections from some of the Shakespeare rhetoric work that they do in their classes to this text, which is just making it really come alive. It makes sense. You understand the arguments. And so often in rehearsals, I'm asking them like, when it gets too blustery, we can't hear it. So what are we actually arguing about? What is the actual argument here? And that language in the rehearsal room has really kind of opened up so much of the conversation. I also want to share, Tom, because I sort of mentioned this, and I think I'd be loath to, I know we're running out of time, but another phrase in the rehearsal room that I keep coming back to is empathy is not endorsement. In both of these plays, people make difficult choices. They do horrible things. And I think that sometimes we can look at them and we can empathize with characters, but that doesn't mean that we endorse their behavior.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make, too, because, you know, you know, both of us are actors, have worked in the business for quite some time. And one of the things that you and I both know is that you work on a character, but you can't judge the character. You have to play the character. And that's so important.
Yep.
I want to let the listeners know before we go, Dan, I'm very excited for you for the summer. You're going to be in Shakespeare in Delaware Park. You're going to be in The Winter's Tale, which is, I believe, the first production. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Yes. And you're playing the role of Leontes, which, you know, for all practical purposes, is really the title role. How exciting for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's so incredible. It's an incredible company, and I stand in incredible footsteps, Tom Laughlin, working for that company. So,
yeah, well, I wish you the best. And, you know, if you happen to catch a break, I think there might be a couple of complimentary tickets to The Price if you think you got time for that. You know,
I will definitely try to do that. Yes, and I'm so looking forward to our production of Death of a Salesman, where you will play Willie Loman and I will play Happy, coming to a theater near you in 2026.
Love it. Pitch it. I'll be there to pitch it for you.
Thank you.
All right, Dan, thanks very much. Good luck with everything. Good seeing you.
Thank you.
The Crucible and Abigail 1702 will run concurrently in rep from April 26th through May 4th. The Crucible will be presented on April 26th, 27th, and May 2nd at 7:30 p.m., with a matinee performance on May 4th at 2 p.m. Abigail 1702 will be on stage on April 27th and 28th at 2 p.m., and May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 p.m. You can get tickets by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. Thank you. Here is the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks in the region. A reminder that the acoustic roots duo of Gary Smallwood and Michael Pfaff will be at the Opera House on Friday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are still available at the box office, 716-679-1891, or online at www.fredopera.org/tickets. You can hear an interview with Michael Pfaff on the previous episode of the podcast from April 3rd, the Total Eclipse edition, at aisleseat.podbean.com. The Department of Theater and Dance will also be presenting its Envision BA Symposium today, April 17th, and again on Thursday, April 18th, from 5 to 8 p.m. in the Costello Conference Room at the Rockefeller Arts Center at SUNY Fredonia. The BA Symposium represents capstone projects from students in the BA Theater Program and is coordinated by Dr. Nestor Bravo Goldsmith. Admission is free. Along with that, the Envision BA Showcase Capstone will be held on Friday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. in the Bartlett Theater and will feature performance works by the BA graduating students. The School of Music has many, many events coming up as the academic semester winds down, and they are just too numerous to mention them all here. Just to highlight two of the events, the Claudette Sorrell Artist Residency will feature noted flutist and composer Valerie Coleman, sharing her musical journey through performances, masterclasses, and panel discussions from Thursday, April 25th through Saturday, April 27th. And the SUNY Fredonia Chamber Orchestra will perform on Wednesday, April 24th, from 8 to 10 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. If you would like to see a listing of all the School of Music events for the rest of the year, there is a link in the show notes you can click to get to the arts events calendar on the university's website. Finally, local author and lifelong Chautauqua County resident Joan Wall will be at the Darwin R. Barker Library in Fredonia on Saturday, April 27th, beginning at noon, for a book signing event for her latest book, Summer Love in Music City. The book will be on sale at the event. Cash only sales, please. And remember, if you have an arts event that you'd like to get on the arts calendar, just call 716-679-1891 with your information, or email to operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll include your event. Please give us a month's advance notice to ensure a timely mention. One of the Opera House's best-kept secrets may be the Ecstasis Duo 2.0 Young Artist Recitals. These student chamber music recitals came about as a collaboration between the 1891 Fredonia Opera House and the Ecstasis Duo, composed of pianist Eliran Avni and cellist Natasha Farney, both School of Music faculty members. The next recital in this series will take place on Thursday, May 2nd at 5:30 p.m., and I caught up with Dr. Avni, as well as Opera House Executive Director Rick Davis, to discuss the history of this series and the unusual opportunity it presents to the region. So I am joined now for this segment of the podcast by Executive Director Mr. Rick Davis of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
And also with me is Dr. Eliran Avni. He is Associate Professor of Piano over at the School of Music. Eliran, welcome.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, so it's great to have you both. And we're here to talk about the Ecstasis 2.0 Young Artist Recital Series that's been going on for at least a year now, as far as I'm concerned. And we've never really had a chance to talk. Yeah? Yeah.
More, three, right?
Yeah, October 22 was the first one.
Okay, yeah. 3 years. Yeah, and we've never really had a chance to talk about them on the podcast and talk about, you know, what, how they've developed and where they've come from and so on and so forth. So why don't we start from there? And Rick, we'll start with you as the executive director. It's your venue. What's your recollection of how all of this began?
Well, it actually started before the pandemic, and the Opera House had an anonymous donor come forward and offer to subsidize the rebuild of our 1918 Steinway piano. And we did that. And then the pandemic hit and the piano wasn't getting played. So post-pandemic, we offered to several faculty members at the School of Music that if they had students who needed a different piano to practice on, they were certainly welcome to come to the Opera House and use the piano. From our selfish reasons, we wanted it to be played and to loosen up the action. And, you know, after a rebuild, piano needs to be played for a while. And some students took advantage of that. And in 2021, as we were coming out of the pandemic, Elleron and Natasha, the Ecstasis duo, gave a performance at the Opera House. And in conversation about what was happening with some of the students using the piano and with Elleron and Natasha, Elleron suggested, we have this outreach program that Natasha and I do. We call it Ecstasis 2.0. And it's young artists, student artists from that are both students of ours and of the School of Music. And we look for other venues for them to come and perform in. And is that something that could work at the Opera House? And we've been really happy with that. Our first one was October of 22, and we've done 8 to date. And we have the next one coming up on May 2nd. And we've been thrilled with them.
And Elleron, for you, when you first heard about this, what was your initial reaction to this idea?
Well, I mean, where to start? I think the first thing I want to say is that as musicians, especially, you know, as students, the reality is that you're preparing a piece usually for a jury at the end of the semester. Maybe you get a chance to play it in a studio class or a recital seminar. But the act of music making as a student is usually associated with a grade and an end result where you have to please somebody. And I know that it's something that in my, you know, as I get older, it's something that I realized was a big mistake in my education to not get the opportunity to go out and play for real people, people who just came to enjoy the music, came to be moved by the playing. They don't care if it's stylistically correct or how I'm using the pedal. They just wanted to enjoy the music. And I think that feedback from the audience is so, so, so important for the students to move away from, you know, what they're doing wrong to just sharing the music because they love the pieces that they're playing. So that's how this whole thing started. I just wanted to give them more opportunities. If they learned a piece, they can play it in 3 different locations and they can, you know, you learn the piece differently after 3 performances. You get to different realizations, what's working, what's not working. It's a growth process. It's really how it should be. It shouldn't be just one performance. And so we started, we did a series at Westfield in the Patterson Library, and we did a series in Casadega in the church there. And then when Rick and I were talking about it, and I think that the segue here is that the hall, the Opera House, is so incredibly beautiful. Who doesn't want to play there? It would be stupid to not want to play there. And I thought, well, if they need the piano played, I can solve that for the institution. And I have a line of talented students who would love to play. And that's how the whole thing started. And so the first reason was to give them a chance to play. The second reason, it's such a beautiful hall to experience music and to perform music. And so from our perspective, when you're playing in a small practice room, you hear the music a certain way. When you go on the Opera House stage and you play the same piece, it's a completely different story. It's as though the hall becomes, I don't know, this resonance box to the piece. Everything is bigger. Everything is much more colorful. It's the reverb is enhancing the music. So it's a completely different experience for the students on stage performing. And this is what real life is. You don't perform in a practice room. You perform on a stage for an audience that is sitting sometimes very far away from you. And that's a whole different way of expressing and making music.
I was just going to add, and from the Opera House standpoint, while our initial objective was to get the piano utilized, this has turned into a wonderful series of young artists' recitals that we can offer to the community on a free admission basis. So it's almost, as I view it, it's like a win-win-win situation. The Opera House wins, the piano gets utilized, we have these wonderful young artists, talented young artists performing. The audience gets to come and hear incredible music by talented musicians, and the musicians themselves are getting to play in a different venue from where they are usually accustomed to playing. So it's turned into something that we're really thrilled about.
And what's been the reaction from the students, Eliron? Their opportunity to get the chance to play in the a hall.
They love it. They love it. They can't wait. And I noticed that especially the groups, the chamber music groups that are getting ready for the concert here on campus, they always want to run it in the Opera House because it's a great chance for them to run through the piece. And again, it's so close to school. It's like it's on our backyard, literally. And so just walking to the venue, performing, coming back, it's so simple, so easy, and so rewarding.
So yeah. What kind of repertoire do you usually have for those students, Eliron? What do you like them to play when they go to the Opera House?
I was thinking, like, how am I going to explain this? But it's a little bit like, you know, when a chef wakes up in the morning and goes to the market and see what they have. A little bit what happens when we program. Rick will send me, I mean, he's very patient. He usually waits till like the day before to see. And I try to not to come from, you know, under the rock that I'm under, like, oh my God, what are they going to play? Who's going to play? It's always sort of a last minute type of thing, but it's exciting too. Something is ready and I feel like, okay, these guys can go on stage and they can have a good experience. That's what goes on stage. There's never an agenda or, you know, trying to make a theme. It's really people are ready and they feel comfortable going on stage, and we try to limit it with 60 minutes as a total performance time. And it's kind of exciting because I think the audience comes and you see different, you know, different levels of ability and talent and preparation and how people deal with nerves and how some of them really get a bounce from the adrenaline of performance, and some of them it takes them a little bit down. And I think that's exciting to see. I mean, these are, you know, artists in training. They're learning how to go on stage and give a solid performance. So to answer your question, I don't know. Whoever is ready gets to play.
Okay, there's fair
usually,
enough.
There's usually some Chopin and solo Bach for cello because cellists play solo Bach. I love programming some new music, but that happens very rarely. We had the Shostakovich Octet, so 8 string players on stage. We have Rachmaninoff Quartet. We had a beautiful Torino Trio for piano, cello, and violin. So it's very eclectic, and it's never the same. So,
yeah, and that's what I wanted to get across a little bit was that it's not just piano. It's all chamber music. So you've got many instruments coming. It's not just a piano recital.
Right, correct.
And it's been the result has been a nice mix of definitely composers that an audience have heard of, that they're familiar with, but also some lesser known composers' works, maybe not contemporary, but certainly lesser known to an audience. And it's really been fascinating.
Yeah,
but... and instrumentation. I mean, I keep going back to one of the earlier performance recitals. There was a incredible clarinet group that performed. I have a video of it, and they were phenomenal. Yeah. It was a great sound.
Yeah, we had the Poulenc Sextet with, you know, with all the winds on stage. So it really, I usually get emails from students saying, you know, my group is ready, can we play? And that's usually, you know, how it works.
Oh, okay. So you are well known for this on campus, and the students just say, we're ready to go.
Yes,
they want to go. Oh, that's wonderful. I really think it's quite a thing. Go ahead.
I wanted to add that both Natasha and I feel so strongly about bringing to the audience, like you mentioned, like pieces that are maybe less known, but by wonderful composers. So I know both she and I are very passionate about women composers and you know, mixing up the usual, you know, dead white, you know, usually German composer programs and Chopin. Chopin actually, yeah, he jumps into that group too. And so when the students have that repertoire, that of course jumps to the top of my list because I want audiences to hear that music. I think Camber played, last time he played a beautiful piece by William Grant Steele, who's an African-American composer. I don't know if anybody recognizes that name, but the piece is so gorgeous. It's not summertime. I mean, first of all, Camber played it so beautifully, but then the idea that nobody actually knows this piece and this composer, and hopefully people take the program, go home, and then they do their research and they go, oh, wow, here's another person I should know about. Here's another wonderful composer to listen to.
Rick, I know that when you originally scheduled this, you picked a time, 5:30 in the afternoon, for a very specific reason, date and time. Can you elaborate on that? Why did you pick 5:30 in the afternoon?
Well, that wasn't the time that we actually, the first few ones, we did not do it at 5:30. So we've played around with time a little bit. We settled on 5:30 for actually a number of reasons. One, it works for the students because they're in classes and lessons all day. It seems to work well for them. We tend to have an older audience at the Opera House, and we are always hearing from our older audience that they would like more things offered earlier. Whether it's that they are uncomfortable driving after dark, or, you know, for many reasons that they like to come out a little earlier. And so our thought was that this would definitely be something that all of those people could attend, as well as other students, because we certainly want the students to come out and support their fellow students. I have to say, we've been a little disappointed with the attendance. It's not been up to what we had hoped it would be yet, and I don't know why we talk about it a lot, we promote it a lot, we need to look at it and find other ways to promote it as well and get the word out that this is happening and that it's a wonderful event.
I think maybe Domus Fair should offer a free meal with our free concert and just plugging a little.
I think that's a great idea, Elleron. No matter whether it's free or a discounted price or something like that, you know, you go to the Ecstasis 2.0 Young Artist Recital, go to Domus Fair for dinner, you get 10% off your meal, something like that. You know, hooking it in, Rick, to something. Maybe. You know, maybe
I'll try anything.
I know you'll try anything, Rick. I know that. Well, you tried this podcast, so I know you'll try anything. that's terrific. Just from my point of view, I really want to encourage people to go out and sit. I mean, one of the things that we have that I can't say it enough as someone who's been doing this podcast for pretty close to 3 years now, how much rich art we have around here. I mean, it's just incredible that you can think to yourself, man, I could go down to the Opera House on a Thursday afternoon at 5:30 and enjoy well-played, great music. Where else can you do that?
It's not, I want to stress it, it's not the same like listening to music on YouTube or on your headphones, on your computer. It's not the same. There's an energy. Your body is going to be moved by the music in a different way when you're sitting there in the hall listening to people play live music. It's not the same experience.
Yes. And at 5:30 in the afternoon, you'll be home for dinner, for goodness sake.
or go out to dinner. You know, everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to go out to dinner and then I'm going to go to a show. Well, reverse that. Go out, go to the show first, then go have a little dinner. The concerts, the recitals are only an hour long. So 6:30, it's dinner time. And it gives you something to talk about over dinner.
That's right. And and it's free admission, for goodness sake.
It's free admission.
Yes.
We do have a donation box that we put out. And you know, anyone who wants to throw a couple dollars in, we are grateful if they do that. It helps cover the cost of the piano tuning for the event. But it's free admission.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Now, I can't end this particular segment without talking about the Ecstasis duo themselves, because they have a new album that has just came out. It's called From the Shadows, and it's actually part of the concert that they did back in 21. So, Elrond, give us the background on that.
This is how long it takes to come up with a recording. So we were very lucky that last year we went into the studio in Yonkers and we recorded these beautiful pieces, the massive Henriette Bosman Sonata, which is like a Rachmaninoff meets Ravel type of, like almost like a concerto for the two instruments, and George Walker, another African-American composer who wrote a beautiful cello sonata, a Chinese piece by Chen Yi, and three pieces by Zemlinsky. And so all of that music is on this CD, on this recording. And I don't know of other recordings that are done of this repertoire. It's not like the Brahms sonatas. It's not like the Beethoven sonata that, you know, there are a million choices to have. There are very, very few recordings of this repertoire, and it's beautiful music. So you can go to Spotify, to YouTube, to Amazon, and just, you know, search From the Shadows, Ecstasy's Duo, and it's going to jump up. Literally, you don't even have to purchase it, because all of these platforms are just offering samples of the CD, so you can just listen and enjoy the music.
Great. That's wonderful. Congratulations to you and Natasha. I think it's great that you guys are out there recording and getting the duo out, because you guys are really great when you perform. And it's nice to know that other people will have the opportunity to do that. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for the time that you've given me. Rick, I appreciate it. I know you're always busy doing something. Elrond, for goodness sake, you probably got five things up in the air right now with the end of the semester.
Six, actually.
Yeah. So the time is very, very much, very much appreciated. And, you know, hopefully what we've discussed today will excite the audiences that listen to come and listen a little bit more, and we'll get a few more audiences, because I think the students certainly deserve to have it. You know, they're working very hard to produce this great music. So hopefully more people will come out and enjoy it.
Amen. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks, Tom.
The final Young Artist Recital for this season will take place on Thursday, May 2nd at 5:30 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. As mentioned, it makes for a great evening out, especially on a nice spring day. Admission is free. Donations gratefully accepted. And don't forget that tickets for all the Bach and Beyond events are now on sale online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or at the box office at 716-679-1891. And if you want that early bird discount subscription for all the festival events, you'd better hurry, because the deadline of April 17th to nab that discount is today, the day this podcast is released. If you're listening to this podcast after the 17th, you're too late. You're also too late to be eligible for a free 1891 Run for the Opera House t-shirt, but you can still sign up for the 1891 Run for the Opera House by visiting the website and clicking on the 1891 Run button at the top of the page. The run is Sunday, April 28th at 9 a.m. And that's it for this snow mower edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Dr. Robert Strauss, Professor Dan Lenzian, Dr. Elrond Avni, and Mr. Rick Davis for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through our social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there. And be kind.
to one another.